Jeff Funk, good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan Papik.
And Don Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court, counsel, everybody in the courtroom. We appreciate your wearing masks. But when you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Our first case of the day is State versus John. And Mr. Jacobs, you are here this morning. You may approach. And Ms. Klein, you are also here today. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No.
Mr. Jacobs, you may proceed.
Thank you, Justices. And I would reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal time, although I don't anticipate on using the full 20 minutes. Your Honors, appellant's arguments before this court boil down to one finding by the district court about 3 years prior to the trial of the appellant. That ruling and that finding by the district court was that appellant was malingering psychotic symptoms and trial, and then trial counsel's subsequent ineffectiveness related to this finding when trial counsel waived appellant's right to a jury trial. This finding by the district court after that competency hearing is what set the tone for the entire case from there on out. Just briefly, a competency hearing for the appellant was held over the course of 2 days in early 2017. A total of 3 doctors testified at that hearing, 1 for the defense, 2 for the state, and I believe the district court received 11 exhibits at that time. Dr. Gutnick was the first to testify for the defendant, appellant, and he was the first doctor to see the appellant in April of 2016 after he was arrested in December of 2015. Dr. Gutnick testified that at that time, in April of 2016, appellant was too psychotic for him to administer any evaluations. He based this decision on the appellant's loose associations, auditory hallucinations, and delusional thoughts. Dr. Gutnick therefore diagnosed the appellant as schizophrenic or potentially had schizoaffective disorder. Appellant was sent to Lincoln Regional Center for further testing and evaluation shortly thereafter. And he was at the Lincoln Regional Center from, I believe, July 12th of 2016 to sometime in August. Upon discharge, appellant was diagnosed with malingering. Dr. Hartman testified for the state at that time and based his decision on what the staff who had seen the appellant daily reported to him, that appellant was not confused or disorganized, that he was going to meetings on time and was able to find the location of the meeting without getting lost. Dr. Hartman's opinion was also at least partially based on the initial assessment of another doctor from July 12th, 2016, when appellant was accepted to LRC.
Counsel, is this a competency question or an insanity question?
I believe it's an insanity question based on the ruling at the competency hearing.
Based on the, was there evidence that given at trial on the insanity defense?
There was evidence given at trial on the insanity defense, yes.
Was the competency decision appealed?
The competency decision was not appealed by prior trial.
Okay, and it's not raised as an assignment of error here, is that correct?
That's correct.
This is whether the court erred by not finding him not guilty by reason of insanity.
That's correct. Okay. And I believe that the decision at the competency hearing is what led to the decision of insanity.
Did we have new evidence at the trial?
There was new evidence from the time of the competency evaluation to the trial. That evidence being that the trial was essentially 3 years after the competency hearing, a little over 3 years.
And the facts of the case were stipulated to by the parties.
That's correct. Yes. So was there
live testimony at trial?
There was live testimony by doctors on the issue of competency. There was also live testimony from counsel at the time of the competency hearing from the public defender's office, as well as an additional doctor that was retained by the appellant at that time.
What is our standard of review? This question.
Standard of review is, if I recall correctly, it's abuse of discretion on the trial court's decisions. This court does not reweigh the facts as they were outlined by the witnesses. However, I believe that the trial court erred in finding that the burden to prove insanity is by preponderance of the evidence. And I believe at the time of the trial, the defense proved that by preponderance of the evidence. So I believe the district court erred in that ruling that Mr. John did not suffer from a mental disease or defect, number one, and number.
Excuse me, are you asserting that the district court cited the wrong standard of review, or that the court cited the correct standard but incorrectly applied it?
That's the second one, Justice. Yes, the district court, after the competency hearing, had ruled that the specific language from that order was, in the matter before this court, Dr. Gutnick and Dr. Hartman first differ as to whether defendant suffers from a mental illness. These polar opposite findings symmetrically affect each psychiatrist's ultimate opinion as to whether defendant is competent to stand trial. Dr. Gutnick submits the defendant suffers from schizophrenia, while Dr. Hartman submits the defendant does not suffer from a mental illness, but is rather malingering. Appellant believes that that decision colored the entirety of the remainder of the case. As I am,
it's kind of a bias argument.
Not necessarily a bias argument, Justice, but more so that, and partially is that trial counsel, after the competency hearing, new trial counsel was appointed. That trial counsel was ineffective for waiving the defendant's right to a jury trial on the matter. Appellant believes that from looking at the competency hearing, trial counsel should have seen what the decision on the first element of not responsible by reason of insanity was, which is that number one, he does not suffer from a mental disease or defect. And the same trier of fact that had determined that at the competency hearing was going to be the one weighing in on that at the trial, on the stipulated bench trial.
Competency and insanity are assessed at different times, aren't they? I mean, if for insanity, we're looking at the time of the offense, and competency, we're looking at the time of the trial.
That is correct. But at the competency hearing, the district court found that appellant was malingering and did not suffer from any psychotic symptoms. So appellant then waived jury trial, knowing that that would likely be the trial court's decision at the stipulated bench trial.
Do we know why the appellant waived his right to jury?
We do not know why.
So are we able to reach that?
I believe we are able to reach that, because on my drive down here this morning, I was trying to think of a comparable instance in which a trial court or a trier of fact would have potentially previewed their decision. And since this case was involving a murder in the first degree with a life imprisonment as a sentence, I could not think of a comparable situation. So I think that the fact that trial counsel had appellant waive jury trial, knowing what the likely outcome of the insanity defense would be, was ineffective at that time.
You realize you're asking us to do for only the third time what this court in divided opinions has done only twice before, and that's to determine ineffective assistance without the benefit of post-conviction evidence.
I understand that. Yes.
That's a pretty.
And I think that this case is a very unique set of circumstances due to the.
You're familiar with the cases that I'm talking
yes.
about. So how does this compare, and how does it fit in? And given that at least some members of the court that dissented before are still on the court, how do you anticipate convincing us that this is one of those rare?
As I indicated, I could not think of a time or a comparable situation in which a trier of fact has previewed their decision of what would be the ultimate outcome on a case, namely the not guilty by reason of insanity. Number one, the first element being the defendant had a mental disease or defect at the time of the crime.
Aren't you presuming sort of an element of pre-decision on the part of the trial judge?
Not necessarily that, but the trial judge previously in 2017 had found that the defendant was malingering psychotic symptoms shortly after the crime had taken place. So.
Did the judge find that or did just determine that he was now competent to stand trial?
The judge had determined that he was competent to stand trial.
Does that have any bearing on what his condition was in December of 2015? I mean, when was the decision made to define he was competent to stand trial?
I believe it was in February of 2017, is what I recall.
So over a year later, the crime was in December of 2015.
Correct.
So in, let's say, February or March of 2017, he finds that Mr. John is competent to stand trial. Is that to show that then he predetermined that he was competent or he was not insane at the time he committed the offense?
Not necessarily that, but I believe that as Dr. Newring testified, and I can't remember, I apologize, I wasn't trial counsel, I don't remember if it was at the competency hearing or at the
motion to suppress, maybe.
And it was even the motion to suppress. Dr. Newring testified, it'd be reasonable to think that if appellant was having an experience 4 days before, a day after, and hours after the homicide event, that he would likely have the experience through the homicide event. I believe that the way Dr. Gutnick testified and evaluated John in April of 2016, a few months after the incident, that he was displaying the same behaviors that he was in December of 2015 when the event occurred. So that, as I indicated, I believe that previewed the decision for the insanity defense in this case.
Changing the subject a little bit, when your client waived jury trial, I assume there was a colloquy client and the judge about waiving rights and understanding what was going on.
There was.
What effect does that have on your argument?
I believe that although he did have that colloquy with the district court, Dr. Hartman from LRC indicated in one of his evaluations, and like I indicated, there's a handful of evaluations by both sides, so I can't remember which date of the evaluation. Dr. Hartman found appellant to be borderline intellectually disabled with an IQ of around 79. So I believe as counsel for appellant, that appellant would not have made that decision without discussing that prior to with trial counsel at the time. So although the district court inquired about that to the appellant on his own, appellant believes that that would have had to have come from trial counsel. And that's something, yeah. If that answers your question.
Thank you.
The other ineffective assistance of counsel claim deals with the stipulation at trial and some waiver of self-defense. Can you explain that?
Again, there's many evaluations, so I don't recall exactly which evaluations it was in. I recall it wasn't in the first few evaluations, but closer toward the end, because after the competency hearing, there were many more evaluations that the court received. And in a few of those evaluations, the appellant indicated that the victim in this case had a knife in her hands and had come at him after he believed she was trying to take his land that I think his father had owned. And in the stipulated trial, that was never brought up through testimony or anything like that. Since the facts were stipulated to that appellant was the one that had stabbed the victim multiple times, since appellant was the one that had been arrested and the autopsy showed that death was by homicide.
So what evidence was there of self-defense?
Evidence of self-defense, there was, sorry to interrupt, the evidence of self-defense was his statements as well as a cut that was on his finger. I don't have my brief in front of me. I noted the exhibit number in my brief. I want to say it was like 400 and something. It was a photo on his finger of a cut. Appellant was found by Douglas County or Omaha Police Department shortly after the Body of the victim was found within, you know, the same morning. He was photographed and a noticeable cut on his knuckle.
Was that exhibit part of the stipulation?
It would have been part of the stipulation, yes.
As a matter of fact, it was a photo on his shorts showing what appeared to be blood, and you could see the hand as well.
That's correct, yes.
So that did come into evidence?
That did come into evidence. That wasn't argued by trial counsel at the time, though.
So the other piece of evidence would be some statement he made to Dr. Gutnick or?
Dr. Gutnick or Dr. Hartman, or there was other doctors at Lincoln Regional Center as well. Dr. Simple Bond was one that testified.
So did that come into evidence?
Those evaluations did come into evidence, yes.
So those were before the trial court?
Those were, yes.
But the trial court didn't find self-defense in this case?
That's correct.
As a matter of practice, isn't it relatively difficult to maintain both a theory of self-defense and a theory of insanity at the same time?
Yes, I would say it is. However, the trial counsel knew of the allegations of self-defense or the statements by appellant at the time and chose to stipulate to a bench trial with just, you know, submitting all the evidence and all the reports when counsel could have, for instance, not stipulated to the bench trial and put on evidence of both of those facts.
The record, however, does not show us why counsel did that.
That's correct.
Which circles back to our previous discussion.
But as this court knows, I have to raise every instance that I know of ineffective assistance of counsel in order to not waive that on post-conviction proceedings. The other thing I would indicate is I believe the trial court erred in the finding by preponderance of evidence of insanity. I think that, as we indicated, there's multiple years between the competency hearing and the time of the trial. And during that entire time, after the first competency hearing, the defendant was on an antipsychotic medication called Zyprexa, used to treat schizophrenia. He remained on that the entire time of the pendency of this case. And Dr. Hartman testified, I believe he testified at the trial, that LRC could have taken him off Zyprexa. However, they did not do so. So I think that is another piece of evidence that should have been given greater weight by the trial court in making its determination of insanity. And with that, I will reserve the remaining 3 minutes or so.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you. And you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, representing the state in this matter. Your honors, there were, I believe Hartman testified, there were 9 evaluations conducted of this person throughout the course of this. And it's, I couldn't keep track of what was rendered in what particular evaluation, but essentially what we've got are, over the course of time, seem to be the 2 standard camps, Gutnick and Neuring on one side finding him incompetent, and Dr. Hartman and the LRC staff finding him to be completely competent, and in fact, in this case, malingering. Long and short of it is, the district court heard all this evidence, took it all into consideration, and said, I find the fact that the Lincoln Regional Center staff had the opportunity to observe John over the course of literally weeks on basically a 24/7 basis and found it particularly significant that Hartman testified that John had no difficulty comporting with the rules and requirements of what he was obliged to do while at our LRC. He was able to get to his appointments on time. I think he in fact held a job of some sort while he was there. And it was only basically when they sat down to start talking about the situation and his circumstances that John started to exhibit what I'll call bizarre behavior. And Hartman also noted that this behavior morphed radically over time. Over the 4 years that he'd been repeatedly examined, the whole thing had changed from, oh gosh, I don't know anything about it, to being able to give some substantial detail about what had happened. John would frequently say, oh gosh, I don't remember, I don't know, but And Hartman said if you pressed him on detail and kept pressing him a little bit, then he would relent and give you answers to the questions that you were asking, and they were appropriate to the question, and in fact gave you some information and insight about what was going on with him and what happened with the situation. Without trying to go through all the evaluations and all the evidence, the district court found him to be competent to stand trial, and at the trial found him to be not insane at the time of the events. With respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, I think some of them,
Justice Castle asked Mr. Jenkins, what is our standard of review on the insanity determination?
I believe it's an abuse of discretion. Excuse me. With respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, I think the waiver of the jury trial has been preserved. I don't think we can resolve that on the record because, as this court indicated, we don't know why exactly that was done. I think there are a host of reasons why it was a wise move. This was a particularly nasty homicide. John murdered a woman half his size and twice his age, whom he called his auntie, and stabbed her 29 or 30 times, first with a pair of scissors and then with a knife. The stab wounds were inflicted to the head, the torso, and I think significantly the back. And then he went to great pains to clean up the scene that he had created. He literally washed off the body. He took the bloody clothes off of her, the towels that he had used to mop up the scene with, threw those in the washer, took some Clorox and some other cleaning supplies to clean up the situation that he had created.
To be fair though, even if all that information were coming from the judge and he would have heard it all, the sentence wouldn't have been any worse than it was, would it?
The facts are what the facts are, but I think if you trot that out in front of a jury and then you claim that you were insane, the jury is going to substantially look askance at that. And I mean, this is a nasty homicide. I mean, they're all nasty, but this one is particularly ugly.
Is your argument that the fact that he attempted to clean up the murder scene, that's indicative of knowing right from wrong?
That's exactly right. And Dr. Hartman said that is clearly indicative that he knew at the time that what he did was wrong. And that at one of the interviews, John even said that, he claimed not to have actually remembered the homicide, but he remembered distinctly cleaning up the scene afterwards and gave him kind of a laundry list of the process that he went through and the things that he did. And he said he knew he needed to do that because he'd done something bad and the police would be looking for it.
Ultimately, you're speculating that the trial counsel potentially looked at this as, I have two bad options, and the waiving the trial court is the better of the two bad options.
Basically, I think probably we need to hear from trial counsel exactly what he was thinking as to why the waiver of the jury trial was entered. But I think it's been preserved, and I think there are substantial reasons why it might have been waived. I don't think it can. What I'm saying really is that there's reasons why it would have been done. We don't know exactly what those are. That awaits something down the road.
What about the second issue of ineffective assistance?
The stipulation
and somehow implicit waiver of self-defense.
Basically, John wants to have his cake and eat it too. He never really alleged self-defense. He mentioned it to some people, which I guess might be, he brought it up as a potential topic. But I think he was really focusing on the insanity. And frankly, I think self-defense would have been a loser from the get-go. Like I said earlier, this is a woman twice his age, half his size. He referred to her as his auntie. Even he said that he didn't really know why he did it, but at one point while he was at her house that night, the idea literally, he said, just popped into his head that she was trying to take his land and to kill him. And from thence, the assault and the murder occurred. At some point, 29 stab wounds goes above and beyond self-defense, particularly in light of the fact that he said he attacked her with a pair of scissors when she came out of the kitchen holding apparently a kitchen knife. And she dropped that He picks it up and starts stabbing her with that. I mean, at some point, self-defense ends when the threat ends. And even if we assume that this old lady posed a threat of some sort to him, when she drops the knife, she, after having been stabbed repeatedly, she is no longer posing a threat. And at the point he continues the assault, then self-defense just has to evaporate and he becomes the aggressor.
So can we reach that issue based on this record?
I think we can. I think we can.
Is it an issue of deficient performance or an issue of prejudice? What do you say is the strongest prong to that consideration?
I think from my perspective, I don't think he suffered any prejudice because it simply wouldn't have gotten him anywhere. And I think we can resolve that on the record that we have before us. I think insanity would probably, because frankly, up until this whole record revolves around competence and insanity, and the self-defenses from what I see in the record is kind of an almost an afterthought to the thing.
Opposing counsel identified two pieces of evidence that would have supported the self-defense, one being the picture with a cut on the hand or the finger, and the other one was a statement made to one of the treating physicians about this fear of being attacked with a knife. Are those pieces of evidence in this record?
They are. The photo of the cut on the hand is, I believe, exhibit 114. And if you look at it, if you've ever had a cut on your hand, it's clear that this is in the process of healing. This is not a recent cut. You can see pink granulating tissue on the thing. This was not inflicted just a few hours before.
So the court had that information before it when it made this determination?
Yes, it did.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. If I could go back to this issue of, or are we still in it, the ineffective counsel for waiving self-defense. As Justice Castle has indicated, it's the very rare case where this court has or could or would say that without examining the defense counsel, we would be in a position to say no proper defense counsel would have done this thing, right? And so we would just go forward on the direct appeal. Very rare, right? But is the mirror image also the case, or is it a different standard? Are you asking the court to say that this is a good decision and we know it based on this record prior to deposing trial counsel and getting into a post-conviction evidentiary hearing?
The question on direct appeal is whether or not the record is sufficient to resolve the claim. And I think the record as we've got it before us is sufficient to resolve the claim, because I think you have to look at whether or not self-defense would have gotten him anywhere. And I think the answer to that is clearly no. And I think at the time of trial, they basically believed that as well, because there really isn't much at all.
That's a no prejudice argument, right?
It's a no prejudice argument, right. He wouldn't have been prejudiced because it wasn't going to get him anywhere. By far his stronger argument, and I think because the record contains literally hundreds and hundreds of pages on the subject, was the competence and sanity thing. There's virtually nothing in there about self-defense.
So I beg your pardon. So the analysis would be with respect to the Strickland standards that whether or not this is a smart decision is an issue of deficiency or lack thereof, but whether or not it would have done him any good is a question of prejudice, a different pigeonhole, if you will. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we can resolve it on the prejudice prong, and if there isn't going to be any prejudice, then the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is resolved.
Thank you.
Yes. Your Honors, I think, unless there are additional questions.
I'm going to ask.
All right. Then unless anyone else has additional questions, then we would ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. 3 minutes and 10 seconds.
3 minutes and 10 seconds, Mr. Jacobs.
Thank you. And going back to the issue of insanity at the time of trial, I just want to point out the fact that the decision that appellant did not suffer from a mental disease or defect at all. I think as I indicated previously, the district court erred in that decision. And I think part of what needs to be looked at is Dr. Hartman and the LRC staff indicating that he was malingering. In order to malinger, the appellant, as indicated, had a borderline IQ of 79. And what was pointed out at the trial, and I believe was not given enough weight by the district court, and this is why it's an error, is that he would have had to have malingered the symptoms of psychotic symptoms, as well as malinger the symptoms that get better with taking Zyprexa. And someone with a lower level IQ of that nature, I don't believe would have been able to do that. And appellant asserts that part of the finding that he did not suffer from a mental disease or defect was an error by the district court.
You are, candidly, you're asking us to reweigh the evidence.
I'm asking this court to look at the evidence that was presented, and I believe that it shows the error by the district court, the abuse of discretion in finding that he did not suffer from a mental disease or defect.
But if you have opposing experts and the trial court is presented with evidence that cuts both ways, how do we write that to say, without reweighing the evidence, that somehow the trial court heard?
The evidence that was presented by appellant at the time of trial, I understand.
You like that evidence better? Doesn't it really boil down to that?
Of course I like that evidence better. Of course I do.
Fair enough.
I also believe that goes in some weight to trial courts or trial counsel's decision to waive jury trial when previously the trier of fact had essentially ruled that appellant was malingering.
If our standard of review on this question of insanity is that the verdict of the fact finder will not be disturbed unless there is insufficient evidence to support such a finding, why is the evidence on this record insufficient to support rejection of the insanity defense?
As I indicated, I believe that the evidence is sufficient with the testimony that was presented by the doctors, as well as by the previous counsel that was called to testify, from her interactions with John on either the day of or the day prior to the offense. Does that answer?
But the question isn't really. the question isn't whether your evidence is sufficient, it's whether the state's evidence was insufficient.
Correct. And part of that is, I believe that, as I indicated, I believe that the district court was in error in the weight that they gave that evidence with the, sorry, my time is up.
You may finish your thought.
With the evidence that was presented at the trial.
Isn't it really a defense of the Dr. Hartman and LRC staff didn't make a correct determination? Because there's differing issues of malingering and testing and Dr. Gutnick and Dr. Neuring do some malingering testing with different results than what Dr. Hartman and LRC does. And they believe that the medicine that was prescribed by them improved his situation over a course of time. Aren't you really saying that Dr. Hartman and LRC just didn't get it?
Yes, and I believe that can be shown in, I believe it was Dr. Chertruvi was the one that initially saw John on July 16th of 2016 when he was there. And by 11:20 a.m., he had diagnosed John with malingering on his initial day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus John. You are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Drake.